So you have been a longtime focuser, and your work is something you describe as dynamic inquiry.
Yes. Yeah. So there, as I hold it, they're two different bodies of work, but they're also overlapping. I had known about focusing since 1995, and I'd started taking workshops and attending a changes group in 1998. And then a couple of years later, I took my first dynamic facilitation workshop from Jim Rohn. And I was part of what really attracted me to this work is that I felt like the listening skills that I'd been developing, not just in focusing, but also in other peer-based work before that, were really, really were kind of the base of this approach to working with groups.
So something about noticing that it's about listening skills.
Yeah, and when I hear that back, skills can sound a little technical or mechanical or something, but it's about a listening attitude, and it's about our ability to really, I guess the way I describe experiential listening is really accompanying a person in a way that they really feel gotten.
So really a sense of listening as being there, accompanying people so that they feel gotten.
And I think in some conventional facilitation approaches, I don't know if people would agree with this characterization or not, but it's almost like people are wanting to stay on the surface so that we can kind of wrangle people into agreement. And for me, the other really, great parallel between the focusing work and this dynamic facilitation work I was l learning, which eventually became my own work in dynamic inquiry. But another parallel was that this sense of setting up the conditions for something to emerge. So we are not trying to wrangle anything. We're not trying to move people along. We're not trying to, we're just trying to set up the conditions where a natural process can begin to happen. And so because of that, we are taking our time to really get each person in the group.
So the opposite of staying at the surface.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so really getting into the underlying process and setting up the conditions for something to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was so excited by. I remember being at a Treasure Maps workshop with Ann Cornell and Weiser Cornell and Barbara McGavin, and Ann was working with inner conflict and modeling how that happens in Treasure Maps. And so she was, listening to one part and hearing from it and listening to another part, and she's kind of offering a metaphor, kind of holding both parts in her lap. And then she said, well, and I just listen to each one and help each one be heard, and then something happens. It's not like the synthesis is something that we laboriously create. It's something that we allow to happen. And when I heard that, I was like, oh my goodness, the dynamics of working with inner conflict in at least in this inner relationship focusing for format are it's the same pattern, it's the same energy as working with outer conflict in this particular group approach that I'm learning. So that was the moment when I decided I wanted to continue to move forward with my focusing training, because I felt like I wanted to have the inside dimension of it and the outside dimension of it.
So that similarity between the inside dimension and the outside dimension, and that sense of listening to the two sides of the conflict, inner conflict or outer conflict, and then, being in presence of it as opposed to laboriously trying to resolve it.
Yeah, absolutely. and trusting in the emergent process, that when we create conditions of safety. And how I've come to define that in the working with groups world is that when we create the conditions for people to shift into their creative brain and outside of their defensive posture, that we as human beings will naturally be looking for ways to synthesize and for things that will work for everyone. And so, mm-hmm. so we don't have to try and, you know, somehow get that to happen. We can just create the conditions where it will spontaneously happen on its own.
So maybe I would like to rephrase it in a way that puts more emphasis on something that was there, is that it's not about forcing to create it, but creating the conditions. And what was important was that sense of safety, as opposed to, you know, you were mentioning the defensive posture or the fear. And so that's the block.
Right. Like I don't think focusing happens very well either when we're not in a safe space, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that I think that safety is one of the essential conditions for us to slow down enough and really, you know, and maybe we can find a way to create that safety for ourselves even when the outer situation is unsafe. But still, that sense of safety that I think is really created by the presence that we're offering is what then, you know, it's a welcoming, it's an acceptance, it's a trust, and that's part of what allows the shift to happen spontaneously.
Yeah. So that the two go hand in hand, that, you know, if there is safety, then the shift can happen and then we can allow it. But in order for it to be possible, we have to create that safety.
Yes, exactly. So I really, I talk about in my work, I talk about how we want to maximize the creative tension in the situation. Like, we want to hear from all these different perspectives. And at the same time, we want to minimize any interpersonal anxiety. And the way we do that externally in this process is by something I call taking all sides. So just like in the inner relationship work, we're taking all sides. We're listening to each part and helping it feel heard and understood and welcomed and safe on this big lap. Likewise, when we're working with the group, one way of doing so effectively is to see one's role as that of creating safety by helping each person feel like their perspective is a contribution.
So the two imperatives are hearing all sides and avoid anxiety, and so your role as a facilitator is to welcome each side, each person, each point of view as something that's a big part of the group.
Yeah, and I want to tweak that just a little bit because I don't know that we can avoid all anxiety, but I do want to minimize it in the sense, and specifically the interpersonal anxiety, because I think that there is a way that when we are confronted with a whole bunch of different perspectives, we can feel a little overwhelmed, or we can feel like, oh my gosh, how are we going to make sense of all of this? But interpersonal anxiety is more that sense that someone is going to attack me and criticize me, and I will need to defend myself because, you know, everybody in the group might end up ganging up on them afterward, you know, or following them and ganging up on me. And, you know, I think as human beings, we tend to carry a lot more social anxiety than we are conscious of and aware of.
So you make a big difference between, on the one hand, the anxiety that comes from absorbing new material and, you know, in a way expanding and all these kinds of things, and the interpersonal anxiety, the thing, the baggage in a way that we carry, that maybe we're going to be excluded and, and attacked. And you go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, and I've just gone back to school for a PhD because I really want to study all this stuff in depth. But I think I remember hearing about how there are social psychology studies that if even one person in a group validates our perspective, it really shifts the mm-hmm. dynamics of what happens, right? That's what I was saying before, is that I see my role when I'm working with a group is to make sure that everybody feels like there's at least one person in the room who's really genuinely interested in what they have to say and is willing to make space for the contribution that is.
Right. And so it's not just an abstract notion, but that in a way the what the facilitator does is giving the experience, it's a lived experience,
yes.
that the opinion is welcome. Because,
absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That's crucial. That's mm-hmm. a lovely distinction, Serge. This isn't a principle. This is offering each person the experience of being heard. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in a way, that's a big phrase, like the group offers each person the experience of being heard. And from that place, that's the antidote to the sense that, oh, I'm going to be attacked from my position.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, and I think it, I wasn't initially thinking I was going to speak about this, but one of the things that fascinates me is that I feel like we are living in a culture where there's a very ingrained pattern of argument as battle. You know, that mm-hmm. the way to get to the truth is to joust with one another. And George Lakoff, in his book, Metaphors We Live By, describes that in great depth. And so I think that it's very easy sometimes for people to kind of compartmentalize and feel like, okay, so when I'm focusing, I'm in this very, soft, gentle, whatever space, but then okay, so now I'm in the world and I'm in a meeting and I'm with a bunch of people and we need to get stuff done. So the only way we can do that is to kind of shift into this other very mainstream cultural argument as battle kind of people advocating their positions and like that. Because it's a cultural myth. I mean, it's a cultural imprint that we all carry within us to some extent, that that's the way to get things done, or that that's the way to get at truth, or that that's the way to be effective and efficient. And what I really enjoy about the work that I do is it's how can we bring the same kind of spirit that we have when we're, in some kind of nice, warm interpersonal encounter with people to a process where we are really are focused on outcome.
Yeah.
So at that point, it's not that we're going to sit around and navel gaze or, get into everybody's like deep personal stuff or anything like that. But still, the power of listening deeply, the power of making space for each person, the power of allowing our natural synthesizing ability to emerge is, in my experience, it's very powerful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in a way, what we're talking about is, on the one hand, there is the cultural norm we're accustomed to and through which we experience the conversations in our life, our arguments, battles, attack, I hurl something at you, you hurl something back at me, neutralizing, taking position, and the language of battle. Mm-hmm. And what happens in that sense is people become either attacking or defensive, or actually both.
Yep.
And, what we're talking about is a question of creating the safety, the softness, the gentleness of the inner process of focusing, and not creating it by just telling people, oh, you have to listen to each other, but by embodying it and creating the experience of it so that as each person feels that their ideas are accepted and embraced, then it is possible to relax, and by relaxing, to be able for everybody to hear other people's experiences as well and to digest them.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And we can do this when we're working with something that is hugely practical, even technical, et cetera. There's a wonderful example I like to give. When I was a lot younger, I worked for a while for a nonprofit that was an educational reform organization. And they used a lot of constructivist learning approaches and a lot of dialogue in the classroom. Well, I thought dialogue in the classroom was a wonderful idea, but I was initially really puzzled because they used this approach even for teaching math. And at first I was like, well, wait a second, how can you teach math in a way where you are listening to each person's way of approaching the problem, because isn't there one right answer? And I remember reading this wonderful article talking about how if we created a space in the classroom where each person was free to explore their own thinking about how they had arrived at the answer that they had without feeling like they were going to be judged or condemned or criticized or put on the spot, but just with the genuine curiosity. Oh, you came up with a different answer. Let's hear, you know, what you did. What were the steps? What, you know, that people, a lot of interesting things start to happen. One is people would start to self-correct and catch their own mistakes. Oh, well, here I did this. Oh, wow, I see how, you know. So, but also people might then in that kind of environment feel free to discover new ways of arriving. An answer. So even if they did get the right answer, it wasn't about getting the right answer, but about the deep understanding that can come when we share our thinking process with one another and discover that there's many ways of engaging in problem solving. So that's the kind of thing where I feel like no matter how technical, practical, you know, et cetera, the issue is, we can create an environment where we can listen to people's thinking. So in a way, this is more like TAE maybe than like the focusing process, because we're not necessarily in a work context trying to get into each person's deep felt sense about something, but we want to hear their thinking.
Right. And so I think that the reason that that example is so beautiful about, say, for instance, math, is because ostensibly it's about, you know, something where there's a right and a wrong answer, and the only thing that's interesting is the answer. But in a way, thinking about it this way is forgetting that actually what is happening is it's about teaching people math. Or in an argument, it's not about what's right or wrong, but it's about coming to an agreement. And in both cases, we're talking about process. And so what this approach does is put the focus on process and engages people's curiosity about process. And then by being in the process instead of the right and wrong mode, there's the possibility either of learning or discovering something new or of creating a different form of communicating and connecting.
Exactly. Yes. As the German people say, genau. Exactly.
So you were starting to mention how this is, you know, more related to TAE.
I mean, I have a friend and colleague, Mickey Kashtan, who works in the NVC community, and she works with, her work for the last several years has been about how can we take our NVC practice and extend it out into the world. And she specifically has also done things about how to bring NVC practice into the workplace. And one of the things that she talks about is how there's a shift that needs to be made, because sometimes people who are trained in NVC are, you know, they're very into processing their feelings and all of that. And that if we are using NVC in the workplace, we need to recognize that the central focus of the workplace is accomplishing a task. So if we bring in NVC in a way that people start to feel like, oh, well, this is really touchy-feely because everybody's like really getting into their own personal process and their feelings about this and their needs about that, it can provoke a reaction against it. But instead, if we remember that the focus does need to be the work and keep that as a center focus, and in order to get the work done, we are listening to each person's contributions, we are considering each person's feelings and needs, then we have a process that is inclusive and makes room for each person, and at the same time doesn't become this, you know, it's like we don't lose sight of our key objective, which in the math class might be like, how did you solve this math problem, right?
Yeah. But that's also a good example in the sense that we're not talking about process in a way, in addition to the goal, but what makes the group come together is that there is a common task. So in a way, doing, quote, just process would be a way to separate the group from what brings them together.
Right. Exactly. So we want to keep that focus of why we are here clear. And because we're trying to get a task done or to accomplish something, ideas are going to be a big part of this. This isn't just about felt senses and feelings and personal meaning and personal insights. It's also about, here we are trying to get this task done. I have an idea about how we might go about it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a cognitive, it's a conceptual thing that we need to have the space for that to be heard in a non-defensive way. Right?
Yeah.
And likewise, someone else might be looking at it from a different perspective, and they may have a concern. They might say, well, geez, if we do it that way, then this other thing is going to come up. So we can't exclude the thinking part of the process because it's not me. We have to be making space for people's whole being, so their thinking, their ideas, their contributions, and also their feelings and their felt sensing and all of it. But so in that way, it's a little different because in TAE, we definitely work a little bit more with our thinking. It's not just the felt sensing process.
So in a way, for the organization that would go through this process, essentially, hey, you guys are going through the same process you are, just we're going a little deeper and we're including a little bit more than we normally include so that you can go farther as opposed to we're doing something that's separate or, but just that sense of deepening the process.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that sometimes it's possible to do this work in a almost like a background way, right? Like we don't necessarily always need to be announcing that, oh, we're going to do a different kind of process here, but we might instead be in a position where we just begin to say, hey, let's just hear all of these different perspectives, and then you know, you might not even be the facilitator in the room, but you might say, wow, wait a second. I'm hearing two different things, but I'm not sure that they're contradictory. Let me understand each of them first, and then we can see, you know, where we can go. Can you share what you said a little bit more? And okay, so you're saying this, and that. So it's like there's different ways of doing this work. It can be a more formal, laid out way, or there can be ways that we can do little moments of contribution.
Right. So in a way, another way to put it is as people get more experience of this type of work and this process, then in a way, even without being a facilitator, people can carry it in their own experience of being in a meeting.
Exactly.
And a specific way, for instance, to do that would be instead of arguing, to just take a moment to express, I hear this and I hear that. And so the clarifying, the putting the two things, making them present, as opposed to arguing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. Yeah.
So maybe just to check as we're coming toward the end of this, you know, coming back to, in a way, some sense of similarities and differences for people who know focusing, and maybe a sense of where I might be curious after you, what you just mentioned, is maybe to plant some thoughts of how people might experiment with this in their lives, in conversations with people or in groups, to possibly start playing with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as focusers, I mean, one of the reasons I really enjoy sharing this work with people who are already trained in focusing or who are already trained in MVC or like that, is that I think that when we have these kinds of experiential listening skills in place, it's not such a big step to be able to apply those skills in working with groups. Something that my husband and I do here at home at times, which is just, I think might be an interesting thing to do, is, you know, the basic principle is that when two people are involved in a, you know, there's the positive aspect of shared fields, but then there's also the difficult aspect of shared fields, like, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's a lot easier for me to hold space for somebody who is working on an issue if that issue doesn't have anything to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So,
let me just maybe slow down a little bit, because we're mentioning shared field and not everybody is necessarily familiar with it. So, you know, maybe it's just a way to say it's something that, say, as you and I talk, is not just paying attention to what I see or feel or say or what you say or experience, but what's happening between the two of us, or maybe something that's even larger than the two of us, and have a sense of attunement to something outside or something that contains us. You know, is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yes, kind of. As you're saying that, I'm realizing, like, any word has, you know, multiple meanings. And I was using it in the sense of, like, if you and I work at the same workplace, we are part of a larger shared field. We have a similar context, or maybe it would be helpful to call it shared context to distinguish from shared field. If you and I belong to the same family, we are part of a shared context. If you and I are volunteers in the same organization, we're part of the same context, right? And so I was calling that shared field because I think that any context does create a field as well. So one of the things that people have noticed in the focusing world is that when we share a context, it's much harder to maintain this really wonderful, spacious listening presence for another person because, you know, we're both working on a project and I have a way that I might want to do it and you have a way that you might want to do it. So when you are focusing on the project, I might hear something that, you know, kind of like, oh no, but they're not seeing that there's another way, you know? So the more involved in each other's lives that we are, the harder it can be to hold the kind of focusing space that is much easier to hold when it's just our focusing partner that we see once a week. Does that
right? No, so absolutely. Yeah. So it's like it's not your life and mine, which are separate, and we just happen to meet to talk about your life or mine and no intersection. But say if we're talking about work, there's a context, and then each of us has a, you know, certainly the opposite of detached.
Yes, so, exactly.
And so that there could be the possibility of emotions coming in the way.
Right, exactly. So one of the things that Bruce and I sometimes do when we're home and there's something that we're trying to talk about is we kind of create an imaginary facilitator there, mm-hmm. who's there to hear each of us. And we just, you know, so if it gets a little bit of a hot spot, we're like, okay, so say it over there to the listener. And then it's like we, this sense that it can be so helpful to have a third person whose role it is to help each person be heard. And mm-hmm. sometimes if we have had that experience, we can almost invoke it even when we don't have a third person, because it reminds us that each of us needs to be heard, and that it's sometimes easier to hear what the other person is saying if we imagine that the person is saying it to somebody else there who is reflecting it back to them. Does that make a little bit of...
No, that's beautiful. That's very beautiful. Yeah. In fact, you know, I think that's really very, very nice and concrete. When we talk about shared field or shared context, you know, or maybe just more of the shared field, it's a little abstract and almost mystical in the sense of sensing it. But I love the idea that, say, the two people put a chair in the middle, and so there is a visible third person, and call that third person the field or an internalized therapist or whatever, or a facilitator. And then, in a way, by each person addressing themselves to that chair, you are experiencing the fact that there is somebody who is going to listen to you and pay attention to you, not argue, but simply pay attention to you exactly. in a way that the other person can't necessarily.
Exactly.
And then the field is going to encompass that quality yeah. of each person having been listened to.
Yeah.
So I love that example.
Well, it's helped us navigate a couple of challenging spots. Yeah. So, I remember being in a class in organization development a while back, or a program actually, and we had learned about active listening and the importance of helping a person feel heard. And this was a very internship-based program, very experiential, and so we were actually working with clients and as well. And at some point, my consulting partner and I ended up in a difficulty. And I remember we were in this program, we were encouraged to bring our interpersonal stuff to the professors so that they could kind of help us solve communication issues live, you know, in situ as a way for us to learn this. So we came to our professor, we were saying, you know, well, I'm really trying to have this person get this point, and you know, she's trying to have me understand her, and we just don't seem to be able to get the other person to understand this. And he said, so have you thought about, you know, reflecting back to the person what you have understood about their perspective instead of trying to get them to understand yours first? You know, this is very, very, very basic thing, and yet it can be so challenging. It can be so challenging when we are both triggered to be able to offer that kind of listening and understanding to another person. And I think it's wonderful for all of us to develop the muscle to be able to do that, to pull back from wanting to be understood and instead pause a minute and make sure that we've understood the other person first. At the same time, I think the thing I want to close with is that I feel like in our culture, we're so much like we have to do it ourselves kind of a culture. And I think that for me, it's like, what would our society look like if each of us felt open to inviting in a third person whenever we were having a difficulty, and that we could do this for one another? So like, mm-hmm. you know, we could say, hey, you know, we're trying to have this thing here and we just got snagged. Would you be able to sit for a second and listen to each of us so that we can move forward in a good way? And just like we've learned in focusing that, you know, you don't necessarily have to pay a therapist for everything. It's like therapists are great, but two people can take turns and hold space for each other. Likewise, I feel like we could have a society where we take turns holding space for one another's couples or triads or groups, or, you know, that this ability to hold space for a group is something that many of us could learn to do, and that we could exchange freely with one another. And to me, that's the most important thing about this work.
Yeah. So that sense, a vision where as we each develop our ability to listen more, then we can perform that function for others. And at the same time, as we do, you know, other people can do it for us, but we collectively develop our ability to listen. And we also incorporate that experience of the possibility of being listened to and understood, and change the nature of what a discussion or a confrontation is, or a conflict. Because instead of being a battle, the metaphor of battle, then conflict becomes that space where a third person is going to embody the experience of paying attention to what you say in a, you know, as opposed to criticizing it and hearing it.
Yeah. And where each of those different things, one of the things Bruce says is, you know, when you have two perspectives and they come at each other, mm-hmm. it's a stalemate. But if you have two perspectives and there's enough space, then it's almost like the dynamics of an energy generator. Yeah. Like this could be a, you know, a turbine that mm-hmm. is creating something new, because each of the perspectives are still there, and yet they're able to be in a creative relationship with each other instead of in a stuck relationship with each other.
Yeah. So we're coming to a place of conflict as engine for growth, as opposed exactly. to catastrophe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Great. Thanks, Rosa.
Yeah. And it's exciting to me, because when I look at the focusing world, I see that, you know, so many people have developed this capacity to listen to another person as an individual. And I think it's just, we're such a short step from having the capacity to be with a group in this way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Very exciting.
This is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prangle. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at focusing.org/conversations.